I got it. Yes, sir. Sorry. I'm not even qualified to turn on a mic. Maybe not the only one who's not a doctor on the apologetics crew. I have enough Dr. Pepper in me, though. I think that qualifies. But hopefully what we can do this morning in this class is look at another branch of apologetics, or another way of proving things. And we're going to go to the divine origins of language this morning. I want to begin Job chapter 38. Everybody turn to Job chapter 38. And I want you to notice the way that God reasons with Job in these passages. We're just going to read a few of these verses, but I just want to point out God's reasoning as he reasons with Job. So in Job 38, beginning verse 1, Job 38, beginning verse 1, he says, "Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, 'Who is this that darkeneth counsel by words without knowledge?'" And by the way, in chapter 42, Job's going to say, "It's me," and then he's going to put his hand over his mouth. But this is the way that God prefaces this conversation. And then verse 3, "Gird up now thy loins like a man." God doesn't have to prepare to answer. Man has to prepare to answer. So he's telling him, you need to get prepared to answer some questions. "For I will demand of thee, and answer thou me. Where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare if thou hast understanding. Who hath laid the measures thereof, if thou knowest? Who hath stretched the line upon it? Whereupon are the foundations thereof fastened? Or who laid the cornerstone thereof?" Notice God's logical discussion here with Job. I think first of all, he acknowledges and he points out the fact that creation is here. It's here. The mountains are here. The sky is here. The earth is here. Creation is here. And so he begins by, okay, look around you. We're here. Creation is here. And creation, therefore, and this creation also has an order. He's going to go into Job 38, how there's order within creation. And Ecclesiastes does the same thing. If creation here and there is an order to it, what God is trying to get Job to reason through is, if it wasn't me, then who did it? And this is God's logic with Job. If I'm not the one who put order into the creation and did it, then who did? Think about that, and this is what God's trying to get Job to think like, reason like a man, and go through this reasoning. If I didn't do it, then who did it? Here is, I think, the reasoning process for that. I don't know of anyone who is not in an asylum who would say that creation's not here, that man's not here. Now, of course, there's people who are, loony. I'm not qualified, so I'll just use the word loony. Who perhaps would say we're not here. But most people, if you get in a conversation, they would acknowledge, well, we're here. And so if you start on the common ground of man is here, man's alive, man is here. If you start on that common ground, now what God does with Job is all of creation, but we're just going to focus in on man. If man is here, we're going to say, we can all agree on that point. Man is here, we're alive, we're here. So you have two options now. If we're here, your two options are either, I'm calling him the Omni-God, the God who possesses all omni-traits, superlative traits, omniscience, omnipresence, etc. Either, option one, God made us, made man, since we're here. Or option number two, something other than God made us. That's why we're here. So we're calling that option two, B2, being two. I'm just calling it B2 to represent this other being. It could be an angel. It could be a natural process, like evolution, but there's some other thing out here that you are claiming, because this is the reason we're here. It's not God, it's some other process. Okay, it has to be greater than man, through which we actually can eliminate evolution, because evolution says you start from the lesser and got to the greater. It has to actually be greater than man in order to produce the effect that we see here. So our question would be, okay, in that process now, what is our natural next question? Let's say it's God, then we're done. God made us here. Let's say it's B2. What's our next question? Where did B2 come from? That's our next question. So do you see what's happening here? Either the Omni-God made B2, or there's this some other being over here called B3, who's greater than B2 and greater than man, but less than God. He can't be God or greater than God, because then he'd be God. Everybody with me? So he's got to be less than God, greater than us, in order to cause that us to exist. So what starts happening here? Well, then if it's B3, who made B3? And we go to B infinity. And eventually, what is the natural conclusion from this process? What's the natural conclusion? The natural conclusion is God caused something. He is what we would refer to as the first cause. You heard Dink refer to this yesterday. He is the first cause. He first caused something. You eventually get to there's something greater than all of these out there that made them, and that first cause is God. Now what the Bible is going to declare is there's no B2 through B infinity. There's just God and man. God made man. But even with you reason through it, if it's not God, which is what God is saying with Job, if it's not God, then who did it? That's what he's trying to get Job to get through. Well, Job, who made you? So it's got to be greater than Job, but less than me. So who did it then? And that's what he's trying to get him to reason through. This is what we defer to as the first cause. I would reference Hebrews 11, verse 3. Hebrews 3, verse 4, which Dink referenced yesterday about if there's a building, there has to be a builder. There has to be a first cause that is greater than the thing that happened. Greater than the actual effect. So greater than man in this case. So once we've acknowledged that God is involved in our existence, at some point God's involved in our existence, we accept what the Bible says he had an immediate cause for our existence. But even just acknowledging that God was involved in our existence, here's our two choices now. Either God chose to communicate with us, his creation, or he chose to never communicate with his creation. Those are two options. Just because you can't have it. You're either A or not A. There's nothing left after that. So your options are either he chose to communicate to his creation or he chose not to communicate to his creation. Those are two options. He made us now. Is he going to actually communicate to us? So think about if God never chose to make himself known. In other words, God made us but then stepped back and never wanted to make himself known to his creation. Okay, it's been referenced several times, the concept of deism, where God wound everything up and then stepped back and that's it. He's done. Didn't make himself known. We would either, in order to find out about God's existence at that point, we would either need to have the ability to find God ourselves naturally. That's one option. If we're going to know about God and God has not revealed himself, then we need either have the capacity to find out about God naturally without God's help. Now, Paul's going to say in 1 Corinthians 2, you needed my help, in verse 9, where eye has not seen nor ear heard. But naturally, if I'm going to find out for God just naturally, that's one option. We have to immediately eliminate that as a possibility. And here's why. If God made me, and he made me with the capacity to naturally find him, what does that mean? Well, that means God wanted to be known by me. Or he wanted us to know him. If he created with me the capacity to find him, and then that omni-God who made me had to want us to find him. So I have to eliminate this from possibility that he made us, didn't reveal himself, but then gave me the capacity to find him. I have to eliminate that from possibility because then God made me with the ability to find him. And that would we eliminate that from the possibility. It's not an actual option. The other option is we never know of his existence. Either he makes it so we can find out naturally, or we just never know about him. One of the questions I asked Dink and actually another Chris Jaggi also, two doctors I was talking to yesterday after his vulture lesson. One of the questions that I was wondering was, if you took the vulture immune system and put them in a human, because one of the things he mentioned was their immune system is far greater and far not greater. It's more powerful than our immune system. So my question was, if you put a vulture immune system into a human, would it harm the human or would it just be excessive? That was the question I asked. Is it just too much? We don't need it. And both of them basically answered with, we just don't need it. It's the same thing with our eyesight, you know, to be able to, or their smell. Can you imagine smelling 12 miles away? I mean, I don't like smelling 5 feet away from some of you. Imagine smelling 12 miles away. It's not that it would harm me, it's that it's excessive. It's not needed for me because I don't scavenge in order to survive. And so what that highlights about our God as a creator is he is not wasteful. He is not wasteful. He makes us exactly the way we need to be made to function the way he intends for us to function. He's not wasteful. So if God made us, then decided I'm never going to let man know about me, that would be wasteful. That is counterintuitive to an omni-God. God is not wasteful. And so I think we eliminate that. Look in Isaiah 45, for example, a verse for that real quick. Isaiah 45. Look with me in verse 19. It'd be wasteful for an omni-God to make something capable of knowledge without ever making himself known to that thing that can know about him. In Isaiah 45, verse 19. He says, I have not spoken in secret in a dark place of the earth. I said not unto the seed of Jacob, seek me in vain. He says, I, the Lord, speak righteousness. I declare things that are right. So notice what God said he did not say. He never said to the seed of Jacob, look for me, but you're never going to find me. I never said, seek me, but you're never going to find me. That would be a wasteful God. Hey, you're here. There's some first cause, but you can't find the first cause. That's not the way God behaves. He made us and then wanted us to know about him. That's the way the God of the Bible describes himself. And so he's not wasteful. And in addition to that, Revelation 4 and verse 11 tells us exactly why he made us. I know a lot of people are arguing, debating about that. Revelation 4 and verse 11 kind of seals the deal. For his purpose. That's Revelation 4 and verse 11. He made us for his purpose. Now you can keep on arguing after that, but what we say is what the Bible says. God, for his purpose, made us. And so we don't have to argue about why we're here. We're here for God's purpose. That's what Revelation 4 and verse 11 says. So that being the case, we will now proceed on the fact, the truth that we know from divine inspiration, but the fact, the truth that God made us and he chose to make himself known to us. That is the fact of God. He not only made us, but then he chose to make himself known unto us. And scripture is going to uphold that. That is going to involve language. If he's going to make himself known unto us, there's going to be several options. One option being, he makes himself known through natural means, for example. So go to Psalm 19 real quick. Psalm 19. And go with me to verse 1. Psalm 19, verse 1. So God could have made himself known personally. And then God could have also made himself known through means. So through means, he could have chosen, for example, a messenger. He could have made himself known through a messenger. Psalm 19, beginning verse 1, he could also have made himself known through the means of creation itself. Psalm 19 and verse 1. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiwork. Day unto day uttereth speech, and night unto night showeth knowledge. There's no speech nor language where there is the heavens that he's just talking about, the creation. So when I know what the antecedent of that pronoun is, I can go back and understand the heavens, the earth are the voice that he's talking about here. So it's personifying the heavens and the earth. He says there's not a language wherein their speech, the heavens, the earth, does not communicate to us. So God can reveal his existence to us through something outside of language. For example, the language of us studying creation. Where we talked about that in Romans chapter 1. That's one means through which he would do it. But on top of that, what you can't do is walk up to a tree and say, hey, did the Savior die on you? The tree's just going to stand there blowing in the wind. It's not going to communicate divine revelation that we need to be saved. It can communicate his existence. It can communicate, based on Job chapter 38, the fact that God made it. But it can't communicate how to be saved, for example. So we need further divine revelation in order for that to be communicated. That further divine revelation through which anyone who's in this room is saved, you were saved through divine revelation in language. That's how God had to communicate his salvation, was in language. That's the method through which he used. So that's what we're looking at this morning. I wanted to kind of walk through that process to arrive at why we want to spend time on this, because we want to spend time on this because God used language to communicate himself and salvation unto us to be understood. He's not wasteful. So in Acts 26, when the Lord communicates to Saul, he says he did it in the Hebrew language. Go read it up. Acts chapter 26. He chose a language that Saul of Tarsus would understand. Why would he communicate to Saul in gibberish if his whole point of communicating is, you need to be saved? This is what the verse that I go to sometimes when I'm in Africa and we're studying this, the heavenly language of speaking in tongues. And I say, well, let me give you an example of the heavenly language. When God spoke from heaven to communicate to Saul on how to be saved, he used the Hebrew language. I'm not saying the Hebrew language is the heavenly language. I'm saying God used a language that the one who's hearing him would understand. Or else, why would God communicate salvation in gibberish and man not understand? He's not wasteful. He wants man to be saved, 1 Timothy 2, verse 4. So God's going to use a language that man can understand. And we're going to note here that God gave him that language. And God gave him the capacity to understand that language. That's all God given. Okay? So here's what I want to do. I want to begin at the Tower of Babel. We're looking at the divine origins of language. The reason language had to be divine in origin was so that God was going to assure that he could communicate in an understandable way. So one of the things that we don't a lot of times think of is as soon as God creates Adam, what does God do? Well, he gives him commandments, which means there had to be a language that both of them understood, both Adam and God. Adam had the capacity to not only understand, but obey and put that law into practice. He had to have that capacity the moment he was created. And not only that, he had to be able to teach that to Eve, who in Genesis 3 knew exactly what God said, even though she hadn't been created when God gave that commandment. Adam was a patriarch. So he took that message, he understood it, he processed it, he taught it to Eve. They processed it to the point where they said, we're not supposed to touch that tree. That's not what God said, but they processed it to the point of, if we're not supposed to eat that tree, we should probably stay away from that tree, which is a very important lesson we could all learn. Language was from moment number one. The Bible does not reveal to us what language they communicated in. I know it was recorded by Moses in the Hebrew language, but the Bible does not reveal what language God and Adam first started communicating in. I just know they both understood it. But the Bible does not express for us exactly what language that was. We do know, so go with me to the book of Genesis, Genesis chapter 11. We do know by Genesis chapter 11, the all of the earth was still just of one common language. So whatever language Adam spoke was what they spoke until Babel. In Genesis chapter 11, go with me to verse 1. Genesis chapter 11 and verse 1. The whole earth was of one language and of one speech. So whatever language that was prior to the confusion or the spreading of those languages, it was that same language that Adam had been communicating with God since creation. They were of one language, Genesis 11. Go with me to verse 7. So we know what happens here. They try to build this tower that reaches heaven. And of course, God is going to come down and prevent that from happening. In verse 7, he says, Go to let us, notice the us there, because this is Elohim speaking. Go to let us go down and there confound, that's a verb, Belal, B-A-L-A-L. That's the Hebrew verb here. That's where the word, the name as a place is going to come from. Let us confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. Because up to this point, they all understood each other. And God says, in order to spread, because remember, they were trying to come to one, let's all stay here at one location. What had God commanded them? Not only Adam and Eve, but Noah when he got off the ark. What did God command Noah when he got off the ark? Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth. And what man decided was, no, we're not going to fill the earth. We're all going to come to one location. So God says, let me help you out then. I'm going to make it so you can't even talk to each other, so that you'll keep the commandment I told you when I said to fill the earth. You have to spread out. So what God does in order to accomplish that is he's going to create languages, multiple languages. We're going to see all these demonstrated. In Genesis chapter 10 and verse 25, Genesis 10 and verse 25, we know at what point in the timeline this happens. It says, and unto Eber were born two sons. The name of one was Peleg, for in his days was the earth divided. So I want to point out that the Bible even specifies what generation under which this Tower of Babel takes place. And so for that reason there, the nations of the Bible that precede. Now, if you go back to Genesis 10 and verse 20, I want to point this out. These are the sons of Ham after their families, after their tongues. Now, this is something very important about the book of Genesis. The book of Genesis is divided into multiple genealogies. The first one, according to Genesis chapter 2, is the genealogy of the heavens and the earth. A lot of people go into this, well, there's one creation, Genesis 1, and there's a separate creation, Genesis 2. No, Genesis 1 spells out for you the elements of the creation. Genesis 2 is the genealogy of that creation. That's what's happening in Genesis 10, 11. Genesis 10 makes it sound like, oh, they're already split. No, Genesis 10 is a genealogy. Genesis 11 goes into the description of how they were divided. So you might think of it from the standpoint of Genesis 10 is after Genesis 11. From the standpoint of, they were divided in Genesis 10 into these languages. Look at some languages here in Genesis chapter 10. So we are approximately about 2269 BC in the days of Peleg when this happens, which means from the moment Adam was created to about 2269 BC, about, don't come up to me and say 2270. I should have just put 2370. That's my fault for putting 2269 because everyone's like, oh, you think you know exactly what year. Somewhere between the moment that Adam was created and around 2270 or so BC, they were of one language. After the Tower of Babel, now the languages divide. God creates every single one of them. God creates every single one of them for the purpose of dividing them, for splitting them, but God creates those languages. So during that first period of about 2,200 years, they're of one language. After that, I'm sorry, about 2,000 years or so, a little bit less than 2,000 years. After that, we're going to see multiple languages, and that's what Genesis chapter 10 is going to go into. So Genesis 10 is going to be the genealogy of the three sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And what he follows in Genesis 10, because there's the genealogy of Genesis 2, the genealogy of Genesis 5, which is Adam's genealogy, and then now the genealogy of Genesis 10, which is the genealogy of the three sons of Noah. Each of these sons are going to produce, have themselves sons, and each of these sons are going to produce a nation, or they're going to grow into a nation. So you have examples here. So I've given a few examples. I've given, for example, Elam. So in Genesis chapter 10, if you'll go to verse 22, Genesis 10 verse 22, we're looking at Shem's descendants first. In Genesis 10 verse 22, the children of Shem were Elam and Asher and Arphaxad and Lud and Aram. So he goes into the sons of Shem, those who would be descendants of Shem. And I do want to point out here that's from whom Jesus is going to come. This is the genealogy that's the most important in the Bible, because Jesus is eventually going to come from this descendancy. Elam, for example, was a son of Shem. And I have there that the Elam is going to be to the east of Babylon. The Elamites, the capital city of it being Susa in Ezra chapter 4, Daniel chapter 2. So we have the Elamites there. They're descendants from Shem. We have Asher. Asher is going to be later translated Assyria. So Asher, and I have the Hebrew word up there, is from where Assyria is going to come. So the language that was going to be an Assyrian language initially was going to come from the descendants of Asher. All the verses are, by the way, in your notes. We're going to go through these quickly. Aram, as you see there, is one of the sons, in verse 22, one of the sons of Shem. Aram and his descendants are going to come to speak what language? Aramaic. That's where we get the Aramaic language from the descendants of Aram. It's translated Syria in other places, Judges and 2 Samuel. It's also it's described as settled in the east. Look in 2 Samuel chapter 8, 2 Samuel chapter 8. Just for your, when you go through the prophets to be able to recognize these, knowing the city, the capital city of a nation is important. So that way when you hear Nineveh, you think of what nation? Assyria. When you hear Damascus, what nation do you think of? Syria, okay? So for example, 2 Samuel 8 and verse 5, and the Syrians of Damascus came to succor Hadadezer. So this is when you see Damascus being punished or prophesied to be punished, for example, in the book of Ezekiel or something, just know that that represents the nation of the Syrians. They go back to Aram, and we'll get to that Aramaic language here in a moment. Arphaxad, two generations after him, is going to be Eber. If you've always wondered where Hebrew comes from, it's from this man. Okay, I know we speak of Hebrews as if those who crossed over, and so we use it in the context of Abraham. Abraham certainly was a Hebrew, and that's Genesis chapter 14. He's the first one called a Hebrew, Genesis 14 verse 13. But it's a descendant of Eber. That's where the word Hebrew comes from. I want you to note there, Eber is the man from which the Hebrew language is going to come. Or that family is going to be speaking that Hebrew language. So we would be divided amongst those. Those are all descendants of Shem. So you have several here. You have Hebrews, Assyrians, Lydians. Lud there is Lydia. Lydians, Assyrians, the Elamites, the Edomites, the Israelites, because the Israelites came from the Hebrews. These are all nations that came from descendants of Shem, and they all spoke languages according to the nation they were part of that God divided them in. This is Genesis 10, recall. These are called, you may have heard of Semitic, S-E-M-I-T-I-C, languages. That proceeds from Shemitic, S-H-E-M, and it just means those who proceed from Shem. And I know critics hate that terminology because they don't want to acknowledge it goes back to Shem. But these are Shemitic or Semitic languages. Our whole Old Testament is written in nothing but Semitic languages. Shem, descendants of Shem. Aram and the Aramaic and the Hebrew language. That's going to be our Old Testament. So there's portions, and this is, I think I was mentioned, I don't remember who mentioned it yesterday, but there's portions of the Old Testament, I think it was Mornay, there's portions of the Old Testament that are written in Aramaic, particularly during the Babylonian captivity. That period there is written in Aramaic, which makes sense. But the largest portion of our Old Testament is written in the Hebrew language. I want us to point out both of them are Semitic languages. Both of them proceed from Shem, descendants of Shem. The Hebrew language and, in fact, the Aramaic language, the importance of that Hebrew language being, that's what the Israelites would be speaking. That's the origins of our language of the Old Testament. You then have Ham. There's a lot of them under there. I just want to point out, for example, Mizraim. So go back to Genesis chapter 10. Go back to Genesis chapter 10. And I want to point out, if you back up to verse 6, Genesis 10 and verse 6. So here we have the sons of Ham. And he says Cush, which is going to be later Ethiopia, Mizraim, Put, and Canaan. All those are going to come, develop into nations. Those sons are going to develop into nations. Their families would become nations. The one I want to point out there is Mizraim. It's going to be translated Egypt. From here on out, that word Mizraim is Egypt. In fact, in the Swahili language, which has a lot of ties to the Arabic language, when we go over to Kenya and Tanzania, that's still the word for Egypt. Mizraim is still the word for Egypt. That speaks of the Egyptian peoples. The Egyptian people are going to proceed from Mizraim. They would be speaking the Egyptian language. Obviously, the Israelites would have future contact and workings and encounters with the Egyptians. They would proceed from Ham. You see other ones there, the Ethiopians, the Canaanites, the Philistines also would proceed from Ham. Those who speak languages that proceed from Ham are called Hamitic. Well, what the world used to call Hamitic, they don't like to call it that anymore. Now they call it Afro-Asiatic language. So if you hear Afro-Asiatic language, that's the new version of what we used to call Hamitic languages, because they proceeded from Ham. That's all that means. They're languages that proceeded from the nations that proceeded from Ham. And then the third one is Japheth, the one I want to point out there as Madai. So if you go to Genesis chapter 10 and verse 2, Genesis 10 and verse 2, the sons of Japheth, Gomer and Magog and Madai. Madai is where we're going to get the Medians. So we were talking about in the book of Daniel, the Medes and the Persians. The Medes, the Medians, that language would proceed from the family of this man who proceeded from Japheth. So that would be a language that proceeded from Japheth. That would be the Median people. But you also have there Javan or Yavan in Genesis 10, verse 2. That's going to be translated later Greek or Grisha. So this is from where the Greeks are going to come, or another word for that being the Ionians. You may see Ionians sometimes. These are all peoples who descended, and their language have descended from this man. Now, obviously, there's going to be a slight crossover because English is not among these languages, so we can all recognize that. There are languages that are going to spring from other languages. So, you know, certain of our language came from Greek. Some of our language came from, you know, Old French. Some of our language came from Old English. Not Old English, Old Germanic. Some of our language came from Latin. So further languages after this are going to develop from these initial languages that God created. So I'm not saying that they all, for 2,000 years, they use the exact same words, because language evolves over time. And as we mentioned, you know, as was mentioned in the hermeneutics class, even the way we use English words today has changed from sometimes the way it was used in the past. So certainly language develops, but, and I'm not eliminating that fact. I just want to point out where the origins of them are. And most importantly, the fact that God is the originator of them. That's why we're looking at this. God originated these languages. Okay? So you have our archaeology. And again, I'm not qualified because I'm not an archaeologist. But all I can do is research the work of other people who do devote their lives to this and put it up here. I think Peyton Reed may be here tomorrow, and he has spent time on those things, far more qualified than I am. But you can go to archaeological discoveries like the Moabite language on the Moabite stone. It's circa the 9th century B.C., it's written in this Moabite language. The Moabites descended from who? From Lot. The Moabites descended from Lot. So you can go back to where Lot came from, and you'll know where in fact that language proceeded from. You also have this Egyptian language. This is around 2000 BC. You can go find this, actually. I can't remember if this one's in the British Museum or not. But you have the Duakedi, circa 2000 BC. It's in the Egyptian language. How many of you have tried to use a software before to learn a new language? Has anyone tried that before? What software did you use? Rosetta Stone. Most of you probably use the Rosetta Stone software. That just is a name that's given to the software that comes from the Rosetta Stone. Why do you think they chose that as the name of their software? What's the Rosetta Stone have on it? multiple languages. So they're able to come into this language and compare to, oh, this word over here means this word in this other language. And so you have multiple languages on it. It was a very, very important archaeological discovery, the Rosetta Stone is, because it helped them interpret multiple language, us go back and interpret multiple languages that were written down. All these things are important. I just want to point out we have had discoveries of these different languages dating as far back as 2000 BC. It's a very important discovery there. Okay, here's the purpose of this class being in this category. You're asking, well, why? Why does this belong in a category of apologetics? Here's what I want us to all understand. Hopefully this is understandable as far as how it's being presented here. Let me see how much time I got. Okay. Okay. I want you to understand, I want you to hear me very clearly, this is not the actual timeline of humanity. Okay? Does everybody hear me? This is not the actual timeline of humanity. Everybody on the video, see my face saying, this is not the actual timeline of humanity. Okay? What this is an evolutionary, and I know that this, again, this changes constantly, so don't come to me and say it's 200,000 and not 300,000. Look, I'm not an evolutionist. I have to lean on them to give me what ideas they have currently. This is the one that I found was the most current timeline that evolutionists have for humanity. Okay? And again, this changes constantly. Don't take it up with me. Take it up with the evolutionists. Okay, there's the pre-human world. Okay? Again, doesn't exist except for 5 days of it. 3 million years, you have the first hominid evolves, and there is a picture of a hominid. He doesn't exist either, but that's an artistic representation of what they believed hominids look like, okay, 3 million years ago. That changes, and it constantly is in flux. Don't come up to me and say it's 4.6 billion or whatever. I don't know. Ask the evolutionists. This is what they put. Okay, but then 300,000 years ago, the first Homo sapien evolves. This is one thing that we make sure that we understand so we don't misrepresent. You know, I don't care about their feelings, but I don't want to misrepresent. And so when we talk about how old they say humans are, they actually are saying Homo sapiens are around 300,000 years old. And so now we can welcome them into fellowship, right? Okay, so the first Homo sapien, 3,000 years ago. And there's the process, in case you didn't know what it looked like. That's how they became a human. They eventually dropped their spear. Okay, 300,000 years ago was the first Homo sapien, okay? Now, this is an evolutionary timeline. 5,500 years ago, this is according to them, not according to me, is the oldest uncovered language that evolutionists have uncovered was 5,500 years ago. This is not me, so don't fight me over it. I love this kind of stuff. I love them being in a quandary that they put themselves in. Well, all we're saying is, so now, what is our initial question? You have a Homo sapien evolving 300,000 years ago. The first language that they have found is not for 5,500 years ago. What's our question then? What happened for the other 295,000 years prior to that? They were just, for another 290 something years before they could finally speak a known language. Is everybody with me? That's the quandary that they are in, not us. The Bible tells us what happened. That's the situation they are in. They don't know how to explain the fact that for 200 and something thousand years, a full Homo sapien could not speak to another one. They couldn't figure it out. Listen, babies learn how to speak faster than that. I mean, my less than one-year-old tells me more. Now, they told me more and different, you know, some... I think it was Hattie that just claps at us a lot. We got to rid her of that one. I don't want people hurrying, walking around clapping at you when she wants something. But they can communicate at a very young age. Their problem is they couldn't communicate for 290 something thousand years. Do you see the problem that they are in? This is what language, the problem language presents for them. Now, again, I can only lean on their own words, which is what we're going to do here. I want you to listen very carefully. Now, I'm going to turn. Hopefully this didn't mess things too much up, Ryan, but I want to read this for you. This is out of the Oxford Handbook of Language Evolution. A main challenge in this research is a lack of empirical data. Now, they've already acknowledged something very, very important. What does empirical data mean? Five senses is what that means. Did I just switch it? Five senses is what that means. Through their five senses, information you can learn from your five senses, the data is lacking. You don't say. There are no archaeological traces of early human language. This is the Oxford Handbook. This is not a Church of Christ lectureship book. I'm not putting those down. I'm just saying, I'm not going to a source outside of their own source to prove what they are saying. He says, computational biological modeling and clinical research with, does everybody see that? Artificial languages. What does that mean? Made up language. What have they had to do? Make up languages to try to test things out. They have made artificial languages have been employed by who? By evolutionists, not by Christians. We're not going around, well, Pentecostals are. They're employing made up languages. But true Christians are not employing made up languages, artificial languages. That's what evolutionists and Pentecostals are doing. Christians are not doing that. It says artificial languages have been employed to fill in gaps of knowledge. So when they have a gap in knowledge, what did they just acknowledge they have to do? Make something up. When they have a gap of knowledge, they have to make something up. That's what they've just acknowledged. Not me. I didn't write this. Believe me, I don't have the time. So, although biology is understood to shape the brain, which processes languages, there's no clear link between biology and specific human language structures. Now, what that acknowledges, you can give them 290,000 years, or you can give them 3 million years, and biology cannot result in human language. Does everybody understand what he's saying here? What they are saying here? There's more than one that's written. We're not done with the quotes. They're saying there's no link between biology and specific human language. There's no link there. And so naturally, the Christian is going to say, first of all, duh. But then the Christian is going to say, okay, well then where did it come from? We're back at the beginning again. The language structures are linguistic universals. For a lack of breakthrough in the field, there have been numerous debates about what kind of natural phenomenon language might be. What do they call language, though? A natural phenomenon. So they say we can't explain it. When we have a lack of knowledge, we make stuff up. We know there's no link between biology. But here's one thing we definitely know. We definitely know it was natural. It may be a phenomena, it may be magic, it may be mystical, but it's only natural. Do you see the problem with that mentality? They have to, within a day, because they've eliminated God from possibility, the supernatural from possibility, they have to fall back on, all I know for sure is, before I go to sleep tonight, I have to acknowledge it has to be natural. Go to the book of Jude with me real quick, and then we'll go back to these quotes, I think. Yes. The book of Jude, and I want you to go with me to Jude verse 10. Jude and verse 10. Now, Jude, the context, as Brother Waycaster mentioned this morning, is false teachers that were already there. In Jude and verse 10, it says, but these speak evil those things which they know not, but what they know naturally. Does everybody see that word? The Greek word, physikos, physically, naturally. So he's describing these false teachers, that one of the problems that false teachers have is they are only using the empirical data they have collected and things that they can know naturally, physically. But here's what they do even with that information. Listen to what Jude says. But that what they know naturally as brute, I would encourage you to look that word up, allogos, that is illogical. They are illogical, okay? This is not the logical process. The logical process depends on word. They are not logical. So he says here, they're natural, brute, beast. Beast means beasts. It means animals. And that's what he's doing in this context, is comparing them to animals. They are natural, brute, beasts. In those things, what do they do? Even in the things that they collect physically, what do they do? Corrupt themselves. Does everybody see that? So Dink mentioned this. Dink said, I don't understand how someone who studies biology or is a doctor or something like that, that studies the human body, I don't understand how they can study that, the physical world, and reach a conclusion there's no God. I agree, but Jude gives us the explanation of it. They have to corrupt themselves in order to do that. Because what they can do is show up the next day to their college and say, hey guys, I was thinking about the results from our study yesterday, and they can't be explained through natural means. You can't do that, because you'll get fired, lose all your money, and you know, lose your job and lose your community. You may have to actually give something up. But they do this even in what they collect naturally. I want to point that out. Okay, Next quote. Does everybody understand what we're talking about here? This is exactly what they're going to do. Even what they collect naturally, they're going to abuse. Okay. It is suggested that grammar has emerged adaptationally from the human genome. Now, this is the Oxford Handbook, the same book that said there's no connection to biology, said it evolved from the human genome. Bringing about a language instinct, an instinct towards language, or that it depends on a single mutation which has caused a language organ to appear in the human brain. Like, if I were writing a book, I couldn't come up with this, and so I'm glad they came up with it, because I wouldn't have thought of it. But what they're saying is, it was this mutation, and it all of a sudden appeared in the human brain. Which human? I don't know. Somewhere in that 290-something thousand years, eventually a human, all of a sudden, this genome popped into his brain. And can you imagine that poor soul who had the first genome pop into the mutation that popped in his brain, and he's the only one who can communicate, and no one around him can. He's going around saying, guys, can you pass me that dish? And they're going, and he's like, oh, I'm so frustrated. I'm the only one who has this mutation. Okay, this is hypothesized to result in a crystalline grammatical structure underlying all human languages. Now, I'm not a scientist, so you can ask a scientist if genomes are something that can be viewed. Because if they are, you should be able to view this crystalline genome. Again, I may be sounding like nonsense to you doctors, so correct me if I am. Others suggest language is not crystallized, but fluid and ever-changing. Others yet liken language to living organisms. Isn't that interesting? So it's almost like there's life in language. I wonder who put life in language. Languages are considered analogous to a parasite. Now remember, evolution teaches that survival of the fittest, right? Isn't that what we learned when you were younger? The most fit characteristics are the ones that are going to survive, while the least fit we're going to get rid of them. So what's happening with the language is we have evolved a parasite. We've evolved a parasite hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years later. And that parasite has become very, very fit for us as humans. And trees have not evolved it yet. Others yet liken languages to living organisms. Languages are considered analogous to a parasite or populations of mind viruses. We're starting to move into matrix here. And by the way, when I was in college at Texas A&M, I went up to my philosophy teacher, and I was only awake during the first two units because it was about evolution. I fell asleep the rest of the class, which I regret now, because now that I have four children with a fifth on the way, I would have probably enjoyed some of those children lessons. However, I'm sure it would have been evolutionary. I went up to my philosophy professor at Texas A&M. I went into his office and I said, I have a question for you. Now, this same professor had presented homosexuality as a genetic evolution, that we are born homosexual. And the evidence he used was two giraffes with their necks wrapped around each other. I wish I had not been so poor, because I could have kept that textbook and I could have showed it to you today. But just trust me, I'm not going to hell for anybody, so I'm not lying to you. The picture in the textbook was two giraffes, bull giraffes, with their necks wrapped around each other. They say, look, homosexuality is ingrained within biology. Now, the mistake with them was I happened to have gone to Africa two times at that point already and been on two safaris. And I know that when two male giraffes have their necks wrapped around each other, they're beating each other to death for a woman. Go watch it. They have those horns and they're literally just beating each other to death over a woman. They tried to push that in my psychology class. But I went into this man and I said, okay, let's say evolution is true. Is there a next step? Because we're not done evolving, I'm assuming. No, we're not done. And he said to me, and I quote, I'm not going to hell for any of you. Have you seen X-Men? That was my philosophy professor at Texas A&M 25 years ago. Have you seen X-Men? And I was waiting for the punchline. I was like, yeah, I have. I was laughing. And then I slowly stopped laughing. He's serious. He thinks that the next step for us is X-Men. I can shoot lasers out of my eyes and everything else that's the next step. There's so far little scientific evidence for any of these claims. Some of them have been labeled as pseudoscience. That's what I label it. I would agree with those people. We're not done yet. A few more minutes. In the last 40 years, there's been an explosion of research on this problem, as well as a sense that considerable progress has been made. A sense of it, even though it hasn't been. We're getting the sense that we're making progress here. We argue instead that the richness of ideas is accompanied by a poverty of evidence. We got all these artificial ideas. We're impoverished by evidence to support our artificial ideas. With essentially no explanation of how and why our linguistic computations and representations evolved, We show that to date, studies of non-human animals provide virtually no relevant parallels. We can't study animals to find them out. I remember when I was in college with Chris Jaggi, they were studying sharks at the time to help with cancer research because sharks are immune to cancer. So sometimes you study animals to determine things for humans. We can't study animals to find out about language. The fossil and archaeological evidence does not inform our understanding until they make something up, like they commonly do. And then our understanding of the genetics of language is so impoverished that there's little hope of connecting genes to linguistic process anytime soon, which is perfect for you because you'll be dead by the time we can come back and say, we're still waiting for that evidence. All modeling attempts have made unfounded assumptions and have provided no... Again, you're about to see the site for this. It's not a preacher of the gospel. These are evolutionists. All modeling attempts have made unfounded assumptions and have provided no empirical tests, thus leaving any insights into language origins unverifiable. No joke. Based on the current state of evidence, we submit that the most fundamental questions about origins and of evolution of our linguistic capacity remains as mysterious as ever. Not one person did this. A whole board of people got together and decided on this one. Zero? Does that say zero? Of course it does. Okay, this is my point. If you take the Bible out of the situation, you have to look ridiculous. I'm not trying to embarrass, I want to embarrass the doctrine. I'm not trying to embarrass people. But when you fall for that doctrine, it should be embarrassing to you. And if you had just stuck with divine revelation, you wouldn't have been so embarrassed. This is an evidence for the existence of God being the divine origin of language. I think we're out of time. Thank you.